Okay. Good evening. This large crowd here, I'd like to welcome to the September 19th meeting of the 2019 of the Tompkins County Legislature. Would you, this vast crowd of, we don't even have staff here. Look at this. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. What I meant was we don't have the peanut gallery, you know, like, except for Marcia, our faithful Marcia. Oh, we didn't know. Palindrome Day.
You should call Marcia a peanut.
It's palindrome day. 91919. It's a palindrome. So, okay, roll call of members.
Okay. Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Deborah Dawson.
Here.
Henry Granison is asked to be excused. Rich John.
Here.
Anna Kellis.
I'm here.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Present.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne has also asked to be excused. Dave McKenna.
Here.
Glenn Morey.
Here.
Martha Robertson.
Here.
12 members present.
Thank you, Kathy. I don't see any members of the public, although Paul, would you? Hi, Paul. How are you?
Ducks in the back, too.
Would you like to address the legislature?
Come on.
You can be
honored to be here with you.
Thank you.
And see Marcia.
Marcia.
So far away.
Marcia's wonderful. You're lucky to have.
We agree. Absolutely. Thank you, Paul. All right, Dustin Nguyen from the City Council. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here, Doug.
Hello.
Hi, Doug.
We have just a few things. Sorry. So last night at City Administration, we've been discussing it for a while, but we moved on to Council a proposal to change odd even parking in the city from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., I think it is, to much earlier, 7 p.m. to whenever it ends, I can't remember now, 5 or 6 a.m.
Don't park.
Well, so this idea actually came out of the Fall Creek Neighborhood Association. Residents noted that the hours that odd-even parking were in effect did not line up with when the plow trucks were out, and so a resident actually suggested moving up the odd-even parking time, and that's what we're doing. It helps that we now use Swift 911 to activate and deactivate odd-even parking selectively, and so the number of days that residents are expected to move their cars is vastly reduced to when it used to be 5 months out of the year. And so this has allowed us to create a little more pain in terms of people who have dinner parties or whatever, and you know, their guests have to move their cars a little earlier than they used to, in exchange for better snow clearing and fewer times that's in effect. So the 7 p.m. start time is not set in stone. It's when the second shift starts at streets and facilities. Also, when there's a heavy snow event, you know, we go 24 hours anyway. So this would be kind of for in between. That's probably the major thing. But we had a salary discussion that wasn't unlike the same one that you had a couple years ago about properly compensating elected officials and how that affects who is able to run for office. I've mentioned the West MLK rezoning of the three blocks before. That has moved on to council and will be considered the first week of October. So this is reducing building heights by floor and putting in a setback for the first three floors. 2 days ago, we had a joint meeting with the planning board about the Carpenter Circle plan unit development. So this is the big Cayuga Medical Center project with the community gardens and with, I think, nearly 200 units of housing. 50-ish are affordable, and the other 150-ish market rate with some retail. Response from the planning board and common council is pretty positive, so we think it's moving in a pretty good direction. We're excited for all the amenities that they're bringing. The neighborhood association that I'm a part of, Northside United, has been fighting for Medicaid, dentist work, and other low-income medical options there. And, you know, to Cayuga Medical Center's credit, they are pursuing those things, you know, pursuing the grants and you know, whatever it is they need to do to be able to offer those services. So all in all, we've been pretty pleased with the process of that project. And lastly, the PEDC, Planning and Economic Development Committee, a couple weeks ago continued their conversation about making it easier to build ADUs, accessory dwelling units, so backyard granny flats and other little houses, garage conversions, extensions to houses. It was hard to come to consensus on certain things. So it's a big topic. Eight members of council were there for a committee that, you know, only five people serve on. And the desire for an owner-occupied requirement for building an ADU was split 4-4. There are a lot of other issues that not everyone was on board with. And so basically, staff will come back next month with a proposal, and then the members of the committee will have to amend it point by point, depending on what they want. So it'll come without, for example, an owner-occupied requirement. And if the owner-occupied, well, the pro-owner-occupied rule, people want to do it, then they can try to amend it. But that discussion is continuing. And so that conversation came out of an open house that the city did a couple weeks before that. That had good turnout and good conversation, and reflected a good amount of willingness for city residents for ADUs if they're designed properly and preserve some green space. There's a surprising consensus on not having minimum parking requirements, which is great. So, yeah, that's it.
Thanks very much, Doug. Any questions? Discussion?
And another note, we got three little buses, 35-foot buses, and five full-sized buses with another four to be delivered later. So we'll have 12 new buses this year. This is all TCAT news, by the way. And so midway through the autumn season, we have done this unusual thing where we might amend the schedule now that we have more reliable vehicles. So you may see an updated schedule with more routes to the lesser served rural areas and everything.
All right. Thank you, Doc. I was wondering, the parking change, is that now in effect, or is that...
No, it'll be voted on in October at our October meeting in time for the usual start of odd even parking in November.
Okay, that sounds like a pretty big change. It'd be interesting to see if people are okay with that. Okay. Anything else for Doug? Great. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Legislative privilege. Dan Klein, then Deborah.
This Saturday, September 21st, is the Danby Community Fun Day. It's happening from 10 to 2 at the Danby Fire Station in downtown Danby. There's a parade, there's a chicken barbecue, there's games, there's live music, vendors. So put it on your list of things for the weekend. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Deborah, then Annie, then Rich.
So it's lovely to be back. I've watched you all on television just two times, actually. The other thing I have, I sent you all an email today in case you didn't get a chance to look at it. Dooley had sent me a letter that several, more than several citizens groups had signed on in support of the asks being made by the youth climate strike organizers for an immediate ban on new fossil fuel projects, immediate halt of all subsidies for fossil fuels, and a $10 billion investment in funding for renewable energy efficiency and a Green New Deal, conversion of public buildings and vehicles to zero greenhouse gas emissions, an amendment of building codes to require new buildings to be carbon emission free. I don't expect that there's a realistic chance in hell that all of these things are going to be done on the timeline that the climate strike is asking for them to be done. However, I think it's important, to the extent that any of you want to sign this, that we let Albany know that we realize this is a crisis and we realize that these actions need to be taken as soon as is consistent with fiscal health. If you want to sign it, I've got it at my desk. There's a place right up here at the top that I saved for Martha, but we can squeeze Mike Ziegler in if you want. Thank you.
Thanks, Deborah. Annie? Before you start, I'm going to ask the folks who went to NYSEC, so I'll give you a couple of minutes here to put you on notice that those of you who went, it would be great to hear from you about something that you attended. So go ahead, Annie.
That's kind of putting me on the spot here.
We can come back to you.
Okay. Yes, we come back. First off, I am prepared to talk about the Ulysses Philomathic Library book sale that's going on right now, and that's at 74 East Main Street in downtown Trumansburg, and that's every day through next Wednesday, except for Sunday. This year they're closed on Sunday, and prices are $1 to $3. Monday is $5 bag day. Tuesday is $2 bag day. And free day is Wednesday, so go on in any day, and please help us out. And, of course, it's a fundraiser for our local library.
Thank you. Annie. Rich.
Thank you. I'll talk about my visit to NYSEC on the public safety report, because that's where I have some input. I wanted to mention three organizations just that recently had events. The first is St. John's Community Services had an open house of the shelter that they've taken over on West State Street, and they just did a wonderful job showing their facility. It's really impressive what they have there, and they also explained it's not nearly adequate to our needs in our community, but they're doing really important work for the least of our brothers there. And I would just like to read from their website briefly. It says, the Ithaca shelter is always in need of the following items: towels, bars of soap, shampoo, deodorant, razors, toothbrushes, socks. So if you have any laying about or want to help them out, they will go to good service there. I also wanted to mention Southern Tier AIDS Prevention, which had its Ride for Life, and they planned very well this year to have beautiful weather, and it was just a great event, as it has been for these many years that they've run it. It was a great day to ride around the lake, and they really do a good job running that event, and it does wonderful good for their organization and our community. And the last is Family and Children's Services had their first, I believe, of annual cardboard boat races, which has been an event that they've run in Watkins Glen on Seneca Lake, not Family and Children's Services, but that event has been over there for many years in the spring. And this is the first time it was held on Cuba Lake out at Ithaca Yacht Club. And again, plan on good weather. And it was very nice last Sunday. It was a very successful event and a really good start for that organization. So I wanted to commend them all.
Wait, how did your boat do?
My boat arrived at the finish line. And I was very happy with that. It then went on to the dumpster.
All right. Thank you, Rich. Shauna, did I see you had your hand up? And then Ann, and then Mike.
So I will actually give my report with HHS.
Okay.
So, thank you.
That's it? Okay. Anna.
Were you going to report out on the two resolutions?
Yeah.
Okay. Then I will leave that up to you. Shauna and I are both on the standing committee for public health and mental health. It was important to give a lot of feedback on both of them to make modifications, I think, to make them better. But they were very dynamic conversations, and both the resolutions were, I think, ultimately unanimously supported. But I'll let you give some more details on those two. There was a vaping and e-cigarette talk that I went to that I found very interesting. There's a growing problem of youth addiction in the state, and I have evidence from Ted Sheely. I talked to Frank on my way home to get a sense of you know, what's the crisis here, and it very much mimics what's happening in the state. And I don't honestly think that any municipality has a really good handle on how to deal with it. But one of the things that was discussed, which I very much appreciated, is unless it's recognized that it is actually serving some need, which is, for example, kids who feel insecure or socially isolated, and all of a sudden it makes them feel cool, and it makes them feel like they get along, and it makes them feel like they belong. If we don't acknowledge that and provide alternative ways to address those same needs, then we're not really going to be able to address the draw of e-cigarettes. And I very much appreciated that public health, social determinants of health perspective. But of course, it means that looking at it from that perspective costs a lot more money, invariably, because you have to do a lot more intervention. One of the things that was brought up in a conversation afterwards was bringing back peer education. In this context, hearing from adults might not be the most effective, but hearing from other peers might be a lot more effective. So I really appreciated that. One of the most disturbing things that I did learn, and it made me feel very out of touch and old, was that the coolest new device in the e-vaping world is an e-vaping watch that you cannot actually tell is a vape, but an e-cigarette, but is an actual watch. So you clip out the actual
looks
watch face,
like this. Yeah.
And it looks exactly like that.
Hold on.
And you puff on it, and you stick it back in. Yes, well, you know. and Annie and I went afterwards to YouTube to check out some videos on it, and we both walked away thinking, oh my God, those are so cool. I think I may have forgotten everything that they said in that hour and a half, and I want to get one of those. No, just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
You could have that and your wine bracelet.
It's disturbingly cool, actually, and that is exactly the point. This stuff's really cool, and it's a big hurdle to overcome. The last thing I'll say, I presented on... I was asked to present in one of the talks, turning greenies into green energy. And I just want to note that our facility is leaps and bounds ahead of any other facility in the state except for New York City, that, of course, has more money than God in this context. So we have three main projects that are going on. We have a project for biodigesters and then cogen.
Just so say, when you say we, you mean the Ithaca Waste Water Treatment Plant, which is not we, but yeah.
We, as right. In Dryden, Town of Ithaca, City of Ithaca, a lot of the wastewater, and farms that raw material is being shipped from other municipalities in the county.
Right.
So we contribute.
County, yeah.
Let's just say something we should take pride in, no matter what.
Yeah, yeah.
Three projects, biochar projects, to convert all the biosolids from the biodigesters into material that can then be sequestered into soil for thousands of years, improving the quality of the soil, but also sequestering carbon, amazing, to the biodigester and cogen project, where they use biodigesters to fuel generation through micro turbines, and that's used to fuel 50% of the plant. And third and coolest, which is what I just came from, City Harbor project, the development that's happening just north of the wastewater treatment facility will be heated heated and cooled by passive energy, which is the heated effluent that comes from the aerobic digestion in the settling tanks that are sort of the conventional treatment part of our wastewater treatment facility. And that heated tube happens to just currently run under where they're going to do that development. So they'll suck up that thermal energy to fuel their heating and system, heating and cooling systems through air source heat pumps. So just, yay, we're very cool here and progressive and rah-rah. That's my report.
Thank you, Anna.
You're welcome.
Mike Lane, did I see Deborah then? Or?
Well, there was something I forgot to mention.
All right. Go to Mike and then Amanda and then Deborah. Go ahead.
Just two things. One, we had Airport Day. And although I wasn't personally able to attend Airport Day, I was able to attend a dinner the night before in Tagannock Aviation Hangar under the wings of the B-17 that came in to be displayed. And I believe people could have rides in it the next day. That was a wonderful dinner, gave a historic context of what was going on in Tompkins County in early aviation, including the Tommy plane, and it was also honoring Dave Sanders, I believe, is the man's name, and he had graduated from Ithaca High School before World War II, went into the Canadian Air Force, transferred to the RAF in Britain during World War II, earned 3 distinguished flying crosses as a fighter pilot. Unfortunately, he died in the 1960s, but he'd recently been inducted into the Air Force Hall of Fame in Canada. And so we were celebrating that because of his Ithaca ties. I was pleased to sit at the table with Mrs. Colbert, who had been his classmate. And she shared with me that he was the handsomest man in that class. So I thought that was kind of interesting. The other thing I'd like to bring up is simply, we haven't heard much from at these meetings from our IDA. And I would really like from time to time if we could have a report on what the IDA is doing. I'm particularly interested in what happened at the last meeting as reported, having to do with the Ithaca beer tax abatement. I see that was a divided vote, and I wondered what was going on, and I just think it's, since we have 4 members of the IDA that sit on this legislature, I'd really like to hear from them from time to time about what's going on there.
Duly noted, and maybe one of us will get our feet under us and then we'll come back around. I got Amanda and then Deborah.
In case folks didn't hear, today in D.C., our Congressman Tom Reed collapsed, and there's not a lot of information. The news article I read, his aide said he was fine, but he was being checked out. So we do wish him good health and hope that he recovers quickly.
Yes, agreed. Thanks very much, Amanda. I think he was taken to the hospital. He was conscious. He was unconscious for maybe 30 seconds, they think. And they don't know if there was any injury as a result of the fall.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Amanda, for bringing that up. Deborah.
Thank you. This morning, Ronnie and I were invited to attend a class at Cornell. It was an advanced urban design workshop. Mitch Glass is in the planning department is teaching it. The students are doing a semester project reimagining the area that includes the Ithaca Mall, the Tops Mall, and the Cayuga Mall. It was really, really interesting. They will be presenting their findings to the village boards, and I will keep you all informed. It was really a lot of fun to see them report on all the factors that they're going to be considering in deciding how this thing should look. There was an emphasis on workforce housing, which is a nice thing, and mixed use, and walkability and all those things that we're trying to achieve but seem to be failing. So I will keep you all informed.
That's great. I mean, that's terrific. I mean, maybe hope something can come out of that. That's great. Shauna, was Shauna next? Anybody else? Annie came by. Annie, then Shauna.
Thank you. So at the NYSEC workshop, I just wanted to give a brief overview of some of the things that I went to and some high points. I first wanted to note, though, one of the things that happened while we were there was a reporter, Cokie Roberts, passed away. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and she was a stellar reporter and did a lot of investigative journalism, and so that's just wanted to note that, and she'll be sorely missed. So at the NYSEC workshop, one of the things I went to was tapping into funds to protect your water, and I was hoping there were some things that we could find out about maybe some funds we could get here. It sounded like you're going to first have to get your water tested for certain chemicals, and then if they are present, then we could get some funding for that. I also went to another workshop, which Martha presented at the Extreme Weather Mitigation and Resilience. I just wanted to say thank you to Martha and Anna, who did great presentations at a couple of workshops there. Very, very smart, articulate people that we have here. So weathering the storm, extreme weather mitigation and resilience. So I want to just tie that one into the one about water, in that there are a lot of different funds available that we might not think that are available for various things. So a lot of the people there were surprised at this could be available for that. So it's just things you might not think about, whether it's, you know, maybe some education for kids you know, against vaping. There could be some funding from some agency, whether it's federal or state, or there's some new program out. So for the extreme weather mitigation and resilience, there's a couple of different programs depending on what you're working on, whether it's culverts was one of the things that was talked about there. As we all know, culverts are a great way to make sure the water's going where we want it to go. And I also wanted to point out one of the workshops I wanted to go that I was really hoping to go to was building consensus in the political environment and understanding dispute resolution, but that was canceled. I heard a rumor it was because the presenters were having a fight or something like that. I could be kidding about one part of that. I went to a workshop on tourism, and they talked about branding. And I know we've talked before about a lot of our branding talks about Ithaca. And they were really talking about branding your county. And so I'd like us to maybe talk with the tourism board and think about that, because it was it really made sense to me of really encapsulating all the things from one end of the county to the other. And when someone gets here, you know, to go from here to go to that end, to go to see things in Groton and Trumansburg and Danby, and so to really encapsulate the whole county.
So you're in support of the wayfinding, then, I get it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the wayfinding signs. Yep.
All the gorges aren't in Ithaca.
Exactly. Right. Our area is gorgeous, too. And so the last thing that we did was, those of us who stayed for both the full days, was we went to Woodstock. And where the Woodstock Act, the actual Woodstock concert was held. And that was, you could really feel the energy there and be standing there up above where the big field was. And
to be clear, that's where NYSEC had the dinner Tuesday night. Like, we didn't
right.
just, but yeah.
We and didn't just go there. Right. I'm sorry, no. NYSEC had the dinner there to show off one of the things in their county, the Sullivan County treated us with a dinner at the museum, the Bethel Museum, I think of something arts.
Bethel Woods Art, Center for the Arts.
Center for the Arts. So, and they have a wonderful museum there about Woodstock. So they treated us to dinner there. And so we got to look for at least for a few minutes around the museum. And I'm definitely going to go back. And you can walk around the grounds. So that was a really great experience. And I got to meet Duke Devlin and got my picture taken with him, who went to Woodstock in 1969 and hasn't left and has now become someone that helps you learn the sites, a site interpreter there. So he's still there.
I think he lives in the lobby there.
I think so.
Yeah. No, in the bus downstairs.
The bus. But, Annie, you know, the thing about branding, it's interesting because I've traveled through there on Route 17 before, and I remember noticing at every highway exit, there's a lovely sign that says Sullivan County. So, like, you know, you're in Sullivan County. Well, of course, we don't have an interstate with exits, but
we do have entrances.
We have entrances, so right. So that's I hadn't thought about that. That was, you know, really a countywide effort. Okay, thanks. I think Sean and then Rich. Is that right? Go ahead.
Thanks for coming back to me. I wanted to just acknowledge that a few days ago I went to TC3. I was invited by Professor Curran to be on a panel of elected officials, and we had a Q&A. We presented to about 100 kids that were there for their lunch break. They were offered free waffles and chicken, but they were very engaged, and they asked some really incredible questions. I was joined by Kelly Preston, a legislator in Cortland County. And it was very interesting as far as the questions that were answered. She talked about some of the different dynamics with their legislature versus ours. And I learned two things. I learned I'm very fortunate to have a 4-year term, not a 2-year term. And then the other thing that I felt really fortunate about was the fact that she was talking about the divisiveness that occurs between their Republicans and their Democrats, and how nothing can really get done in their county because everything is about party, and they argue constantly, and there have just been some really horrific situations that have happened there. So I felt really proud about the fact that all 14 of us, yes, we do have people that come from different political affiliations, not just Democrats. There are a few Republicans here. But I just feel so fortunate that we work together well and that we communicate and that we really don't have the same situations that they're seeing in Cortland, because I think we can all agree that they're having some real struggles, and I think a lot of that's contributed to the fact that they're struggling and working together.
Thanks, Sean. Rich?
Thank you. I wanted to respond to my colleague, Mike Lane, to just talk for a minute about the Industrial Development Agency and the specific question he raised. First, for those who don't know, the Industrial Development Agency is a creature of this legislature that is tasked with providing tax abatements to businesses in the community that further the goals of economic development, housing, and there's various other things that we try to do. And chiefly, we're trying to improve economic development, create and preserve jobs, and improve the overall community. Ithaca Beer Company has been a recipient of assistance from the Industrial Development Agency, and in fact has grown substantially over many years as a result of the assistance that the IDA has provided. And the general structure of that assistance is phasing in future taxes. So the taxes that exist on a property don't go away. So the base level of taxes continue to be paid, but any new development where there's new value put into the building or the ground or whatever is phased in over a course of years. And recently, the IDA had granted a tax abatement for a substantial addition to their facility to do a canning addition where they can put their beer into cans. And this was done, and all the finances were worked out. And it turned out after the fact that there was a question about pretreatment of sewage. And this had not been known to the company before they went into this development and they did the improvements, leading to some real surprise and additional expense. And that was the subject of the tax abatement request, was for assistance in dealing with this unknown expense that had been generated from the local municipal waste authority. And there was some question of whether they should have known or they didn't know. At any rate, it was a difficult project. It led to an additional expense of about $400,000 that was unanticipated. The IDA considered this at some length. There was a public hearing, and there were opinions shared on both sides of this issue. And the ultimate decision was to grant a partial tax abatement for a portion of that expense, I believe at the amount of $165,000, phased in over 10 years. And I was quoted, I believe, in the Ithaca Journal as saying this was one of the toughest votes that I think the IDA has faced. It was very close. And it's difficult because it was looking backwards rather than prospectively at a future development. The drivers, though, were that we as government officials should be working together to make sure any company that's working in our community knows what its requirements are and can plan for them when they're doing development. As I said, it was a tough call, but I think that summarizes in general terms what we decided.
Thank you, Rich. Go to Mike, and then I'll add a few words. Go ahead, Mike, about this. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to welcome everyone to this edition of Point Counterpoint. This will be a new show for us here. So I was on the other side of the issue from Rich. I mean, I respect everybody's decision on this issue. I think the problem with this particular issue, if everybody's wondering why was it so split, was that I just don't see the IDA as a vehicle to solve every problem. Clearly, Dan had an issue with the wastewater treatment plant, and I feel for him on that. I really think Ithaca Beer is an embassy brand. It's a way part of the world knows us, frankly, here in Tompkins County, is that beer. The problem was we didn't create that issue. You know, it was another agency that created that issue. And I can't see us going forward with the IDA as, oh, I have this expense that I didn't know about, and now the IDA is going to step in to use basically taxpayer money to close that shortfall. I think it's a horrible precedent to set. I think the IDA loses credibility when it does things like that. And this is nothing new. I'm not surprising anybody with what I'm saying here. This was in the paper. But I think there were other ways to have handled this. Some people disagree that there were. They said, no, there were no other avenues. And I just don't see this as being a good vehicle to address this kind of issue. I mean, I brought up things like, you know, there was a dry cleaner down on 13, and there was a big issue with where their fluids were going, and that was a huge cleanup cost. And I think they had to bear the cost of that. You know, businesses run into things like that a lot where, oh, I didn't know that this was going to happen. And, you know, and I just can't see the IDA stepping in for those kind of issues. Hopefully going forward, the wastewater treatment facility will address that particular issue, and so it won't happen again. I've been told that they are. So, but again, that's what how I felt about it. I don't think the IDA can actually be all things to all people. It shouldn't be the first go-to for an issue like this.
Anna, is this about the Ithaca Beer vote?
Yeah, I've heard from my constituents, and I think on this, a few of them, the concern was appreciated, unsolicited, that the IDA really should continue to prioritize jobs, and that they felt that wasn't a significant part of the consideration in this case. And the other was a concern of the future perspective of bailing out businesses that we have funded previously, which I appreciated. I'm just sharing those were some of the perspectives.
So I'll weigh in on this as well. The original request from Ithaca Beer was much bigger than what we ended up granting. They originally came and asked for to move their abatement from 7 years long to 12 years. The total abated would have been approximately $350,000, and said it was about $165,000. And we kept it within the 10 years that we usually, when a business comes or a downtown project comes and they say they can document that they have a sort of extreme financial need, they can get, instead of the 7, they'll get a 10-year schedule. The eventual resolution kept it within that 10 years, basically on the same schedule as a business that has a special economic need. It specifically was not about competition. It was specifically about the issue, the unexpected expense with the wastewater treatment, and because Dan Mitchell said clearly if they'd known this at the outset, they could have wrapped that into the original mortgage, wouldn't have been a problem. So the issue was not about competition. In contrast, the previous IDA meeting, we'd been met the Marriott on the Commons, came to us and asked for renegotiation of their abatement. Rich, I can't remember what the parameters were, but they wanted either it was extended or more taxes abated because of competition, or because there was a challenge, they weren't seeing the room nights and they were having trouble meeting their refinancing goals, whatever it was. We said no. We said, that's your problem. You know, we're not here to, as you said, Mike, we're not here to fix every problem. I will say, and it was a 4-3 vote, it was a really tough vote. I will say that, I mean, I don't think anybody was rah-rah, yeah, let's do this. Everybody had trouble, even those who voted for it. The IDA's role is really to find that sweet spot where if a business is definitely going to be successful, they don't need our help. If a business is definitely not going to be successful, that's not a good use of taxpayer abatements. So we tend to work, and the staff bring us projects where it looks good for this business, but they need a little help. They need something extra. And the property tax abatement structure is literally based on their facility, their space that they need, a building that they build, et cetera. So for example, a business that's about software development and has three people in their bedrooms, they don't have a property tax issue. So we don't do those kinds of businesses at all. So I felt that this was appropriate in the sense that the negotiated resolution was half of what they'd asked for, and that it was just one of those that was right on the bubble. So I hope that helps, Mike, in a little bit more explanation than was in the media.
I appreciate it. Certainly on this issue, I'm glad to hear more about the Ithaca Beer thing. But I would like to stress, it would be nice to have regular reports from the IDA.
It's a good idea. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Is there anything else from NYSAC or anything else? All right. Thank you very much. For my report, then, a little bit about NYSAC. There was a lot about CLCPA, the climate bill, about energy and environment in general. As Annie said, the program that I was part of, and I'll send out the slide deck in case anybody wants to poke through it. Anna, maybe you can send us your slide deck as well. I spoke with Mark Lowry, who's Assistant Director of the DEC's Office of Climate Change, and Karina Cavallo, who's with the Hazard Mitigation Planning Office in the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services. And she's really trying to promote the idea of mitigation planning and resiliency sort of wrapped up together. And I said, gee, what do you know? That's exactly what we're doing. Our planning department got a grant from the Department of State to wrap. Now, every community has to do an update of the hazard mitigation plan every 5 years, and we get FEMA money to do that. Our planning department, Scott Doyle, wrote a grant to get additional. I think that one is the FEMA money is $100,000. He got $150,000 on top of that to do a comprehensive study of what kind of disaster planning really is building in resilience to climate, to projected climate damage. So I was really pleased that we were doing what she was trying to promote. I'll also point out that MEGA, the Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance that we helped to, that we founded in Tompkins County, they always have a table there, and their nice little brochure, the centerfold is our Stu Stein powerhouse. The hydro facility, the hydro plant that we have a power purchase agreement, and that enabled investors to refurbish that 100-year-old hydro plant. And Joe Mariana is quoted in here, so I put a couple of them up there on the counter. So I guess one other thing is the Women's Leadership Council has a program in every NYSEC conference now, and on Monday afternoon we heard from Assemblywoman Eileen Gunther and Senator Jen Metzger and Treasurer Nancy Buck from Sullivan County. So always a highlight for me of the conference. And just one other thing, I made contact with George Latimer. He's the county executive from Westchester. He spoke, and I got a chance to talk to him a little bit about, hey, we have a gas moratorium too. They may have the political clout, but we're several years ahead of them on understanding how converting to renewable heating and cooling can actually help you get out of this problem. So we're going to continue to be in touch, and I think it's real important for the communities that are in the middle of this. In fact, a woman approached me from Oneonta. They're having the same exact problem, and they set up a task force like our own task force of a couple of years ago. So those are the kind of things I think are really valuable about going to NYSEC, is finding other folks around the state who are dealing with the same problems that we are. So maybe some are ahead of us in solutions, and some might be a little behind us, and I think it works for everybody. One other thing, tomorrow afternoon at 2:45, there is an announcement, a special event. It'll be a brief event, but important, an announcement by Cornell University about affordable housing. It will be at 28 Crystal Drive in the town of Dryden. I hope as many of you as possible can join us there. So that's what I have. Deborah.
Apropos of our resiliency planning, I read recently that they anticipate there will be 1.5 billion climate refugees by 2030. And
Worldwide,
yes. So I suspect some of them, based on what I experienced during Sandy, will come to Ithaca, and they will probably be people who can afford to pick themselves up and move, and that means that our real estate situation is going to get more acute. I sincerely hope that at some point in our resiliency planning, we start taking into account what refugees, what climate refugees might do to our markets and to livability in Tompkins County.
I couldn't agree more. And another figure that I heard from Mark Lowry of DEC, if you think that it's expensive to deal with climate change, you should be looking at the cost of doing nothing, which is $150 billion to $200 billion a year in this country to deal with the damage.
Right.
The drought, the fraud, the floods, the fires. So it's not like business as usual is cheaper. So.
Right, and each dollar you spend, you gain $5 in having to pay later for mitigation.
All right. Thank you all very much. Appreciate the conversations about the IDA and about NYSEC. Thank you all. County Administrator Jason Molino.
Thank you very much. I have three things to update on. During the budget presentation, I talked about the recent findings with the airport financing and in the finance law that only outlines that a 10-year bond could be issued for airport improvements. We identified, our bond council identified, that there were two instances of home rule legislation that two southern upper airports, I think one is East Hampton on Long Island and one is the Rochester airport, had requested that that term be extended for 25 to 30 years, and that it, I was recommending we move forward with making a similar home rule request. I have since reached out to Jordan Lesser at Assemblywoman Lifton's office, and he is going to begin to look at developing a bill for consideration, which will ultimately first have to come from this legislature. Once I talk a little bit more with him about the details of it, we will bring forward a resolution starting with F&I to GO and then to the legislature for consideration that would make a home rule request allowing us to bond up to 30 years for the airport improvements at the current Ithaca Airport. Would have no reason to think it wouldn't be accepted, considering the state is funding a third of the project. But we'll see what Jordan comes back with, and as I know more, I'll let the legislature know. We had a shooting in the city a week or two ago, which created a series of events for us in terms of our facilities. It was across from the mental health building. Did not involve our staff or clients, but the mental health building went into lockdown. After a debrief with Frank Krupa and some staff, they identified some good things that happened, and we identified some weaknesses, primarily that while we have a policy that it allows for facilities to be shut down or closed, we don't necessarily have a policy that specifically addresses lockdown procedures. And that could be unique and different for each building, and what is the interconnectivity and the communication amongst the workforce when that happens. So one of the things we've identified that I think we're going to want to start to work on later this fall, but probably get into next year, is developing a lockdown policy for our facilities, and what does that mean individual procedure-wise for each facility, which would then lean into training such as active shooter training and what goes on in the building and around the building when a building goes into lockdown under what circumstances. So it was an event that we learned a little bit about our internal operations and kind of highlighted some security questions we have internally that we want to start to work on in the course of the next year. Lastly, the Public Health Mental Health Task Force has been meeting religiously for every other Wednesday for 2 or 3 hours, spending an enormous amount of time evaluating the current leadership model and what the future should or could look like. They continue to meet. They will continue to meet throughout this next month, at which they'll develop a recommendation. They are intending on bringing a recommendation to both boards, the Public Health Board and the Community Service Board, to receive feedback, finalize that recommendation, bring it to HHS, and then ultimately, per the resolution, is present the recommendation to the legislature for deliberation and ultimate direction at that point. It's a good, dedicated group of folks, spent a lot of time, created a lot of research with the support of Amy Hendricks and Autumn Edwards out of my office. So I just want to let you know they're continuing to meet, and I think probably by mid-November, you will have a recommendation in front of the legislature. That's all I have.
Thank you, Jason. Yep. Any questions for Jason? Thanks very much. Thank County you. Attorney Jonathan Wood.
I don't have a report, but I did want to follow up on your comment on the hydro plant. I've been intending to give an update, which I plan to do annually, on the, how the hydro plant is doing, but we've been a little slow in getting the numbers from the utility, so I expect to have a report soon, maybe the next time.
Okay, great. Thank you. Rick Snyder, Finance Director.
Two things. One is on bonds. Jason highlighted the airport refinancing as it develops. It's still too early to bring to you any bond resolutions concerning the refinancing of the current note for the airport, but you will be seeing some activity regarding that before the end of this year. We did adopt 5 other bond resolutions at or didn't adopt, but approved at F&I committee today on five different road and bridge projects that will be going through the budget committee tomorrow morning and bringing it to you, the legislature, to vote upon at the first meeting in October. And these are all projects that work in conjunction with the county administrator's capital, five-year capital plan, and there are projects that you have already heard about. The second item I wanted to highlight was our cost allocation plan. It's one of those not too exciting indirect cost studies that you might not want to read cover to cover, but the finance department has completed its data collection and reporting processes for finishing up on that cost allocation plan. There's about six or seven departments that all have to complete fairly extensive data collection packets in order for the consultant to complete the plan each year. I think we're waiting on just one department now that hasn't completed its portion, but we are near finalizing that cost allocation report. And you may ask, why is this important? This allows us to take certain indirect costs, pass them on to other departments such as social services, health department, mental health department, and those are the ones that go after increased levels of reimbursement from the state. And it's very important that this cost allocation report, which is only around $9,000 or $10,000 every year, generates hundreds of thousands of dollars of additional reimbursement from the state, which is savings for the county. And so we are in the process of wrapping up that cost allocation plan, and it should be presented to the finance department by the consultant around mid-October. And that's all I have.
How often do we do that kind of report?
Every single year.
Every year, okay. All right. Thank you, Rick. Any questions for Rick? All right. Thank you so much. I have the consent agenda. Well, first, are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? All right, I'll go through the not very long consent agenda and let me know if you want anything pulled off. Resolution A, approval of the Hurl Herring statewide expansion five-year contract with the New York State Office of Indigent Legal Services, the assigned council department, ID 8814. Resolution B, award of bid, 2019 parking lot paving project, ID 8901. Is revised as adopted. Is that in our red folders, Kathy?
Yes.
Okay, in your folders. All right. Thank you. Resolution C, budget adjustment, 2019 final state aid, Tompkins County Youth Services Department, ID 8808. And Resolution D, authorizing the county administrator to convey properties acquired through 2018 foreclosure proceedings to Town of Danby, ID 8864. Can I get a motion on the consent agenda? Moved by Amanda, seconded by Annie. All in favor, please raise your hands. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. I've got the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Mike Lane, Chair.
Well, I'm sure you're all thrilled to talk more about the budget. So I'm not going to talk very much except to say that, first of all, I want to commend this legislature on the participation so far at our expanded Budget Committee meetings. We have had generally 12 to 14 members present at each meeting. And that means that you're becoming better legislators because you're becoming educated from the departments. We've heard from 24 departments in the four meetings we've had with their presentation. We've heard probably almost that many over-target requests spoken about and explained to us. We will be having our next meeting. You've got a whole break this week. There's no meetings at all. This just doesn't count tonight. But we will have another meeting on the 23rd of September and the second one on the 24th of September. That will finish our budget presentations. We also had a lengthy capital program presentation from our county administrator at the very first meeting that we had. So I think things are going pretty well for these meetings. We haven't had any fisticuffs. That's always good.
We're going to start voting it, Mike.
I'm sorry?
We haven't started voting yet.
Well, I know it, but sometimes they start early. So I've been kind of happy. Our regular budget committee will meet again on September 20th at 9 o'clock a.m.
That's tomorrow.
That's what I have.
Tomorrow morning. Okay. Any questions for Mike? Thank you, Mike. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslyn McBean Claiborne, Chair, let me know that she has a GIAC board meeting tonight, which is why she's there. And for the public that doesn't know why we're on a Thursday, the whole conversation we had before about NYSAC, that was a conference Monday and Tuesday night. And Wednesday nights, the city has our live streaming equipment and the slot on TV. So that's why we do Thursdays. That's why we're here. And we lost Leslyn tonight as a result. The next WDIC meeting will be September 25th. Housing and Economic Development Committee, Anna Kellis.
We have a full agenda coming at our next meeting. Our next meeting is September 26th. Two big things on the agenda. One, we'll be talking about Jay Franklin, our director of assessment, will be bringing forward a real property law, residential property exemption, something that I've mentioned previously that we'll be talking about. So he has brought that forward. And we will also be having an extensive conversation with our esteemed county administrator about housing in general, our strategy, talking a bit about the Community Housing Development Fund in the context of the fact that we just have this home rule legislation passed at the state, and in doing a reevaluation of what are all the services that we actually do provide and putting it in context. I'm in the process of putting together an extremely complicated and convoluted chart so that we can have in one place what is the county fund with respect to housing right now, because we have little bits and pieces in about 12 different departments and agencies, and they all report to different committees. So it's really good to get that all in one place. So that's what I've been trying to wrap my brain around. So I encourage anybody who is interested in that to come. Martha mentioned the event tomorrow with Cornell. Thank you, Martha. And I would note the last thing. I want to thank Deborah for bringing up what she did bring up with respect to climate refugees. The Northeast will be one of the most temperate and high precipitation locations on the planet, moving forward, at least by estimates of climatologists. And so the expectation is that we really do need to start planning for potential increased housing needs. We do not have land use authority, so that it becomes very difficult for us. So one of the things that I think is really important for all of us, because we do have resources, we have a large planning department that is bringing in training for all of us through, for example, incremental development. They are providing training for all the municipalities as wanted and needed. We have resources in the county. We might not have land use authority, but we have resources. So how do we mix the two of them and help all of our municipalities that we here represent help understand the what may be coming in the future and what it means to create a plan and a vision for their municipality that aligns zoning code with building code to potentially prepare for that future. And I think that that is what incremental development is about. And so even though there's a lot of you that are not on that committee, the Housing and Economic Development Committee, I do welcome you to join in some of those conversations, particularly this one coming up that is a discussion of our strategy to some extent moving forward. So that is next Thursday at 9:30, and that's my report.
Thank you, Anna. Any questions for Anna? All right, Complete Census Count Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
We met on September 9th. We did a recap of our previous meeting at the library. We've got a lot of enthusiasm on this committee. We're pretty pleased. Not only are the legislators working hard, but so are a lot of the folks that are coming to join us. For example, at this meeting, we had Jennifer Tavares come in, and she's going to be at our meetings, along with the folks from the Census Bureau and TCOG. Nancy Zahler is there. And she's quite enthusiastic about this. So we got a lot of things happening. We set up a small committee to begin looking, and Dave McKenna is going to help us with that, looking for locations that we may want to use for this mobile, send out our mobile computers to be able to help folks file for the census in the rural areas, particularly, or at senior centers or others, with some help, because they may not know how to do that. The Public Information Advisory Board is taking an important lead on the census, and we're really pleased that the efforts that they're beginning to make. One of the things they're so far have talked about doing is trying to go to community meetings and talk to people about the census. The whole purpose of our census committee, of course, is to publicize this and get as many people to participate as possible. So if you have meetings and other things, you know, Rotary clubs, Lions clubs, whatever in your communities that you think it would be a good idea for the Public Information Advisory Board members to put on the list and perhaps make a presentation to, please help us funnel that through, if you would. Marcia, I hope we can do that. And I think we're off to a good start.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions? Amanda.
Not a question, but just to follow up on the Public Information Advisory Board, one of the members is works at TCAT. She's the public relations person, works for TCAT, and we talked about at our last meeting getting some banners on the buses on the inside, and we're hoping right away we can get the ones that talk about census jobs, and then coming up maybe in the winter, closer to the census time, we'll get ones that say the census is confidential and, you know, more details about it. So that's one thing that hopefully is going to be happening soon.
Does anybody know how we're doing locally about hiring? I mean, I've heard on the news that they're having trouble finding enough people.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer for that, although I've been getting some feedback from people in the community saying that they've had people knocking on their doors from the census already. Not to take the quiz, but to ask them whether they're actually living there, and they're going through trying to affirm the data that the Census Bureau has about residences.
All right. Anything else? Thanks very much. That's great. Downtown Facilities Committee, Glenn Morey, Chair.
Thank you, Martha. We have not met since the last legislature meeting, and our next scheduled meeting is October 10th. I have no report other than that.
Okay. Thank you, Glenn. Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you. The Public Safety Committee met just earlier today, but before I report on that meeting, I was just going to mention NYSAC. I attended the New York State Association of Counties Public Safety Committee, and I am a member along with Henry and Martha. And it was a full agenda. We passed seven different resolutions on a variety of topics that were doing different things, largely complaining about unfunded mandates from New York State, that there was so much legislation this year with such significant changes in the public safety sphere, and a lot of the cost has just been passed on to counties, and either to pay for it or to figure out what to do. And those range from trying to deal with solitary confinement to medically assisted treatment for people in jail, costs related to raise the age that aren't fully reimbursed, and there's more. But at any rate, it was a lively discussion. I mentioned two things that came up. One was emergency medical services. Across the state, certainly in upstate, this is a significant issue on getting people to volunteer and to support those volunteers in roles, both as first responders and as EMTs. The training requirements continue to get more difficult, and the recruitment process is lagging behind what we really need to have fully staffed responders in our communities. And so there was a lot of discussion on that. The other big topic were the recent legislative changes regarding bail reform and discovery in criminal cases. And while this seems pretty far in the weeds, I just would like everybody to understand that there are very significant changes coming January 1st as to how cases, criminal cases, are going to be prosecuted by our district attorney and all the district attorneys across the state. The process of arrest, when arrests occur, and the when discovery is provided to defense counsel are going to be changed pretty extensively, or I'll just say extensively, and we're in the process of responding to that. At our meeting today, we had a good report from our district attorney that we ran out of time because there's so much there, so we're going to hear from him more in October. And there are some steps we probably want to be taking this year in order to prepare for that. And one of the things I'll just try to raise a flag on now is I believe we should probably be considering a budget adjustment for the district attorney to allow hiring in 2019 for a couple positions he's looking for so that he doesn't have to wait until 2020 to start these people working because of the significant changes that they're going to need to be prepared for on day one. But more to come there, but I did want to just let everybody know. The other thing I would mention from our Public Safety Committee meeting today was that we passed the resolution in support of allowing deer and bear rifle hunting in Tompkins County. So that resolution will be coming to the full legislature. I anticipate this will be a fairly extensively debated item when it does come before us. We have received a lot of information at the Public Safety Committee, and I would ask our clerks to try to gather that and, if possible, share it with all the legislators ahead of time so you have as much information as possible before we get into that debate. And I'm happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Rich. Any questions? Dan.
Can we just confirm that this rifle vote will be at the full legislature October 1st? Is that accurate? Okay. Thank you.
I think it would be. That would
yes.
be the
yes,
next meeting,
plan.
Yes. Did you want to try to delay it? Is there?
No, I just want to make sure that we can convey to the public because there are people interested in this, as we know. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else for Rich? All right. I appreciate the NYSAC report to Rich, and I think it really the bail reform, the discovery measures, they're all, you know, good policies. They just haven't been fully vetted, fully really thought through from the point of view of how it's really going to impact, especially smaller counties, but I guess all of us. So, Mike.
We talked about unfunded mandates till it's out our ears. I can still remember back when Tim Joseph had chair and he put together something called the Pushback Committee, in which we tried to we went to Albany and we lobbied against the state mandates that were coming down. And the argument we tried to use back then was that whatever level of government imposed a rule, law, or regulation, that level of government ought to pay for it. Pretty simple sounding. But over the years, we've seen no change. And it doesn't matter which party is in power. We now all of a sudden have seen a shift to the Democratic Party in total power, and even more state mandates coming down from all these folks that have wrung their hands over the years saying they don't approve state mandates, just like when the other party was, or the Republican Party was in control. So, Rich, I hear you about the district attorney, and you're exactly right, probably. I read that Cortland County, our sister county, has the DA over there has asked for 5 positions because of the new laws. So it isn't just us.
And I guess I'd comment further on that, that I agree this is a useful policy move to make to try to hurry up discovery. And for a lot of counties where the district attorney is not freely sharing discovery in a reasonable time frame with defense counsel, this is good policy. However, Tompkins County has had an open file policy for a long time and works hard to make sure it's an open, fair process of looking at the discovery material. The time deadlines are really short, 15 days from arraignment, which will radically change the process, as I indicated. And our district attorney, not that I want to speak for him, but had a little bit of passion when he was at our meeting today, because he was saying this law was passed without input from the District Attorney's Association, without input from law enforcement or probation. And it could have been a much better law, I believe. It could have been phased in with, you know, gradual timelines so that we compressed to 15 over a period of years, perhaps, rather than trying to do it all at once. What we're faced with is that every district attorney's office in the state, I believe, is out trying to hire, or will be, at the same time. And I think that the district attorneys that don't have as clear a process, we're in a better shape, are going to be looking to hire far more. I've heard of departments that are going to try to hire 50% of their current staff again. How you integrate those number of people in a coherent way in a very short time frame to try to operate is, I think, a recipe for disaster. So a lot of counties in the state, I believe, are in much more serious trouble than we are, but we have to plan for this and act very quickly too. And it's unfortunate that the good policy wasn't implemented in a more measured way.
So with that, the budget adjustment, you meant there are two over target requests in the DA's budget. That's what you meant, try to move those up?
Correct. Instead of starting them on January 1st of 2020, perhaps try to find if we can locate competent personnel to hire them perhaps in November, so that we are operating under the new rules ahead of time, so we don't try to change our system January 1st when we'll be punished if we're not meeting the deadlines.
I noticed Jason looked surprised when you said that.
Oh, okay. I spoke with Rich about this earlier, and the district attorney's request makes reasonable sense, and you know, I would encourage the legislature to give it consideration that a contingency request put in, and he can at least get 60-day jump start on the beginning of the year. If you're going to consider approving the OTRs, I wouldn't delay. Talked with Matt, and I'm also on the Criminal Justice Reform Task Force for NYSAC, so there's legitimacy, I think, to the change in the way prosecution has to happen. The other thing that's also not being discussed is the change that has to happen on the law enforcement side of things and the way they approach matters, the way they distribute information. There's things have to change in the systematically to the way they approach it. They're not going to be able to staff their way out of this change in the criminal justice reform. So as that deliberate, as that comes up, I think Matt presents on Tuesday his budget. I would encourage it to give some consideration if the legislature wants to move forward with those OTRs.
Okay, now those OTRs are accepted in your recommended in your budget.
I've recommended them just to clarify there. One is a paralegal, a full-time paralegal. The other is a part-time investigator. Those were the two. There were some other smaller ones. One was for software, and the other two or three were for some just additional supplies and materials, but they're not really sure where that's going to land. So those are the two personnel requests that I think you're – bless you.
Bless you.
That he has requested. So I
think it just – we, in terms of process on the budget committee, we don't have to tell Kevin McGuire, I want to move acceptance of an OTR that's already in your budget, correct? I mean,
right.
Sort of.
I mean, I think if when we get to the discussion, if it's something you want to consider and it's something that there's consensus with, we can bring a contingent fund resolution that would just be what I would consider a one-time for the remainder of the year, knowing that if there's consensus to approve that OTR, you will approve that through the normal course of the budget, but we would follow up with another contingent fund resolution, maybe brought to the, from the, from the, by a member file, a resolution, if that's the way the deliberation goes Tuesday night. But I would leave it
to the legislature to make that determination?
The expanded budget committee can vote that resolution as soon as you want to put it up, and then it can come to the next ledge meeting.
If that's the direction, we can do that.
We did that with some of the reentry kind of the extra programming we did for reentry forensic counselor, the reentry coordinator. I think we moved those positions up, senior probation officer, earlier in the year when we passed those a couple of years ago. Deborah.
I think that you're getting at the crux of my confusion. I don't see this thing, this one-time thing for this year, for November and December, isn't really part of next year's budget process, except for the fact that there would be no point in approving that if we weren't okay with the additional.
Yes, but, both.
Yes, but so you would want the resolution for this year to be passed as soon as possible, because Matt's going to have to get going right away to get people.
Yeah, and that's what I'm suggesting, is we should be moving to support our district attorney as quickly as we can.
So maybe that should come out of our next EBC meeting.
Yeah, so, and we could maybe sort of take a, you know, actually talk about the target positions, make sure, even though we don't need a motion, make sure that there is support for it before we vote for the contingent request.
And I had one other thing just in comment on what somebody said about it's not just the district attorney. Any evidence that's out there in the possession of a police agency is deemed to be in the possession of the district attorney. So what that does is forces them to act as a unit. And we're going to need to see significant process improvements on how evidence is collected and transferred to a central box for each case, so it gets filled as fast as possible. And it will change how policing is done, as well as how the district attorney is operating. And there's also impacts on the probation side as well, with pretrial reports. So it's a very complicated thing.
Deborah.
So is this going to necessitate additional administrative and clerical staffing for the sheriff's department over and above what we're already looking at?
What my understanding is there would be an additional paralegal at the DA's office that would be responsible basically for processing paper, doing a lot of scanning, because we need to make sure everything is in an electronic format to go as fast as we need to. The other position is a part-time investigator inside the district attorney's office that would direct, there's already two, but this would be a third, would work directly with the various police agencies in the county to be clarifying what evidence is needed for each case and making sure that the police officers are getting it and getting it within the time frames, almost like a quality control program. And that's the plan, is to have that coordination and control from the district attorney to each of the police agencies, and to do training programs before end of year on how the district attorney needs to get evidence from the police agencies. Also, there's probably a component of media and public awareness on this, because it will change how arrests are made, particularly when arrests are made. So
is Derek working with me?
Yes. He was at public safety today, and he was in agreement. Yeah.
Glenn, and then Ann, and then Kathy Covert.
Are we looking for a consensus tonight that we can move this forward?
I don't think you need it tonight. I would recommend that you have Matt present his budget to you on Tuesday, and then pick up the conversation. And if you want to move forward there, you know, we can have that conversation of what the next steps could be, and something could be lined up at the October 1st meeting.
But he didn't make the presentation today in the meeting.
I think he talked about the changes, but
okay.
Yeah. But he'll be coming to the budget.
Yeah, his budget presentation is on Tuesday. His budget presentation. Right. I would suggest you go through that. If there's consensus there, we can prepare something for the following week.
Okay. Anna? I just wanted to know that in the public safety packet, there was a presentation on the recovery reform, discovery, and bail reform. And there was also a really good article that Matt added to our agenda. Thank you, Rich, for including it, that outlines some of these issues. I highly recommend everybody read, just to give some background. I found them very useful. The one thing that I did find really concerning about the conversation that I thought I'd bring up to everybody, because I honestly didn't get it, but the idea that because there's a 15-day maximum or we will incur fines, either we include a budget line in operations, as far as I'm concerned, for unexpected fines, which is ridiculous, or they change the entire process of charging for any criminal offenses, where the charge is actually delayed so that there can be discovery before an official charge. So if you imagine if a police shows up, this is the description that was given, if a police officer shows up because someone was caught stealing from Target, which happens every day, as was noted, there will be an extensive amount of data collected, interviewing, asking questions, and the officer will walk away at the time and not do an arrest or give a ticket. Because once that process is established, then the clock is started. So if you can imagine what that would do, a hamstringing police officers. So that's why they're involved, significantly because of the 15-day limit and how we do things and when we do things in order to make sure that we can successfully collect all the data before those 15 days are up. I appreciated that because I really didn't understand it prior to that presentation.
Yeah, there certainly will be an element of judgment introduced that isn't present now on when an arrest is made, because once you make that arrest, you start your 15-day clock. And so if it is not an urgent matter, and frankly with bail reform, a lot of the people who might have been held in the past won't be held anyway, there isn't a real benefit to the prosecution of bringing the charge right away.
Or issue a ticket.
Right. What will happen, though, is the person who is caught shoplifting will be detained. You know, there'll be information taken from them. They will be identified. A report will be prepared. And they will know that there will be consequences down the line. But that's not an urgent case. If there's a real serious crime, that's where you want to get somebody arrested and off the street. You need to then go very fast on those cases. And so they're going to be a real priority. And this is a way of essentially triaging your cases. But
yeah, well,
it's going to be a real difference to how policing is done and how prosecution is done.
Yeah, the question, Rich, for that is, for me, though, are all of those cases that are not the priorities that now only have 15 days going to be dropped? I mean, so the question that Matt had, you can't drop them.
No.
But how they're done is not necessarily done in a way that feels safe to people. And that's what Matt's concern is that how do you put them in the docket? And what may fall through the cracks somehow.
Yeah, there's going to need to be a determination if there's imminent risk to not arresting.
All right, yes. We can ask Matt more questions on Tuesday night. I would just comment that what was the problem to be solved with this new law? I think there have been many, and I've heard in this progressive, competent county, I've heard many complaints from assigned council members, that panel members, that they have to wait forever to get the discovery materials. They can't prepare an adequate case. And so this is, I presume that if we have a problem here, there are probably other places where there's a real egregious problem. So Kathy has a point about using EBC for this.
I think if you're interested in creating positions and appropriating money from the contingent fund, the resolution should go through the program committees.
Oh, or I think that would be informational at EBC.
Okay.
Certainly we could have a special meeting of the Public Safety Committee.
And Budget Committee on October 1st, maybe, if interested.
Yeah, depending how the discussion goes next Tuesday. But, yeah, it would not be a resolution coming out of EBC. It would be out of Public Safety.
All right. Thank you all very much. Great discussion. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you, Martha. Our last Health and Human Services meeting was Friday, September 6th, and we were joined by Family and Children's Services. Director Karen Jashir presented on the services that were offered at Family and Children's. Anna and I attended the standing committee up at NYSAC for public health and mental health, and we voted on two resolutions. Both resolutions actually dealt with, again, unfunded mandates, the key word for the evening. The first one, and we ended up changing the title probably 50 times, and so I don't have the exact wording for that, but I think we should probably receive an email over the next few days on the past resolutions. But it started out the resolution in support of establishing a temporary commission for the evaluation of Office of Mental Health Housing Programs, OMH, pursuant to S-5637 and A-7489. Essentially, it's asking for an increase in Office of Mental Health housing funding because the housing funding has not received an increase in a very, very long time. And as we all know, housing costs have increased 40% to 70%. And so essentially, they're asking for OMH to provide a higher housing cost there. The second resolution was, and again, this had the same issue with the resolution title that we ended up changing. Initially, the resolution was in opposition to the implementation timeline for new lead poisoning. We changed the title to include the unworkable time frame because they want it to start in October. They're lowering the amount of lead that a child can have in their blood in order for action to be taken, which is a good thing, but they want it to happen in October. And so there's little to no funding that's been allocated for it, and then October is just absurd. And all of the health departments, including the health departments in New York City and other counties, were extremely confused and frustrated because there's no way that they can accommodate that. I believe one of the health directors actually said that in order to accommodate this, they're going to need to hire 11 new people. And so I guess it's good that we're not a bigger county and have to hire that many people, but I can definitely see this even hitting a small county like ours. And so, again, we did change that to include both the unworkable time frame and the increase for funding that's needed. And both of those were passed in that committee. What I'm going to do is use those exact same resolutions and add a local twist to them, as well as I'll ask Frank to look them over and make sure that we're on par. He was happy with the resolutions and did give his input as far as thinking that we should support these on the local level. And then we will, I'll present those at the next HHS meeting, which will be October 5th. And Jude Rose from the Child Development Council will be here to talk a little bit about her position and the work she's been doing over the past year that was funded in last year's budget.
And I would note absurd was actually considered for the title at one point.
Yeah, that's right.
did it end up?
Legitimately.
Did it end up in the title?
I don't think so, but it was legitimately considered.
Realistic. All right.
Realistic was also a word, but yeah. We said unworkable.
Unworkable. All right. The nice, I think the revised resolutions, I looked last night, and the draft that came to the committees, those resolutions are on the website, but I didn't see the changes that we'd made in public safety, so I assume those will go up soon. Thank you, Shauna, but I realize I meant to just comment on talking about unfunded mandates. We blew by something on the other side, the resolution A in the consent agenda, the Hurl-Harring expansion. So New York State is giving us $2.5 million over a five-year period to do more with assigned counsel. So maybe this is like one in the win column versus 100%. Six or seven in the other column. So.
Also, there is one correction. Our next meeting is actually going to be October 4th, not the 5th.
All right. Thank you, Shauna. Who is next? Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair.
Thank you. We met prior to this meeting, and We had one resolution on the consent agenda, the parking lot paving project. Five resolutions, as Rick alluded to, totaling $6,175,000 for various bridge replacement funding streams and road and highway repair and replacement. In addition to that, we had one resolution to execute a supplemental funding agreement with DOT for Ludlow Road Bridge. And that's my report.
Thank you, Dave. Any questions for Dave? All right, thanks very much. Government Operations Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
I did want to say something on the facilities. Dave, I thought it was good news that Arel gave us that those bids on the parking lot pavement were substantially under the estimates that they had for that project by pushing it back until spring.
Yeah, no, that was a good move. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you bringing that up. I should have mentioned that. And I probably should have mentioned that the signs for this building partially are done, and the other part is going to go to the vendor to be done after the meeting today.
You mean the
ones that are in the
office?
Those are on the way to being done?
Yep.
Okay, what happened with the feedback that people offered?
It was in there.
What?
It's been put in there.
Okay, wonderful. All right. Thank you very much. Government Operations? What, Annie?
I just want to also add there's going to also be a sign put on the building to identify it.
Okay. Great. Terrific. Looking forward to that. Then I won't get lost.
Right.
All right. Anymore. That's right. Government Operations, Mike Lane, Chair.
We met on September 5th, and we were introduced to our new executive director of the History Center, Ben Sandberg. We're pleased to have Ben in, and you all saw him, those of us that were here, for the budget presentation for the History Center. So we're looking forward to good things from him. Anna mentioned about discussion about the capital improvements exemption that's been talked about in her committee. We talked about it a little. We've talked about it over the years in the past. I would say it was not embraced with a lot of enthusiasm in the Government Operations Committee. Concerned that it will be a lot of work for the assessment department, that not a lot of people are taking advantage of it. There were only like, I think they said 20 in the city and 12 in Dryden, and the only two municipalities that have it at this point. So we'll be hearing more about it. I think Anna's committee has the lead on it, but it'll be coming back to Government Operations. We had a report from Lauren Cottrell of the Information Technology Department. I have to remember all these names and things. We had asked Greg and him to come in, and he seems to be the one that's most up to date on this, to talk to us about cybersecurity in our county. We all read about these horror stories of municipalities being attacked by these hackers who are sending ransomware, I guess that was the name of what they do, to try to encrypt all of the data that a municipality has and only agree to unencrypt it if they get paid a substantial amount of money. Most recently, I think there were 23 municipalities in Texas that got hit with that. But we also know that there's other kinds of hacking, including the Groton School District that was hacked. I don't know what the extent of that was, but it was listed. Maybe Glenn knows.
Information.
I'm sorry?
They got old information. They did not get
correct. That wasn't true? Glad to hear that.
They got old information.
No, they got they did get information, but it wasn't current stuff.
It was not confidential information.
Use your mic.
It was not confidential information that they
got. Glad to hear it. But anyway, it just tells you that our municipalities and school districts and companies around here are just as vulnerable as any place else. But the good thing is our information technology department is thinking about these things and working on them, trying to educate our employees how to be careful with things like email. And what might come in and how easy it is to click on something and allow in a virus that may infect the whole department or the whole, potentially the whole county. So they're working on that, going to departments and spending time with them, saying what to look for and what not to do when you see something that might be strange. So I think that's really good. Also, there is separation between the department's information, for example. So we're hopeful that if one department got hit, we wouldn't hit the whole county. There are things that they're doing that they would not discuss naturally publicly. We wouldn't want them to discuss it in a public meeting, but wanted us to be aware that they are on top of this and that they are prepared to back things up. So I thought that was kind of an interesting report we had from them. That's pretty much what we did. We do have one resolution. We talked about the open meetings policy, and that is on the agenda. And when you're ready, I'll take that.
Any questions for Mike? Deborah.
I do have one question. When I went to the Taxation and Finance Committee at NYSAC, one of the resolutions that they passed was our dark store one, which was nice. But also another one that got the bulk of the attention from the committee was a resolution that was directed to a law that was proposed last year, wasn't passed, but they expect it to be proposed again this year, that would amend the provisions of the real property tax law affecting foreclosures and specifically a provision that requires a taxpayer to pay their current charges first. It's like reverse chronological order. If they eliminate reverse chronological order, then somebody could technically be a couple of years in arrears forever, and we couldn't foreclose and we couldn't collect that money. I talked to Rick briefly tonight, and he said that that was something that we definitely think is bad, and we would probably want to pass this resolution. But my question is, will that go through government operations or budget, capital, and personnel? I don't have any idea.
I think it would be GO.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Anything else for Mike? All right. Your resolution?
I just want to add a little historic footnote. Before the county started taking over not only the school district payments that weren't paid and paying the school districts, but also the village payments, back years ago, all that the villages could do was get certificates and try to collect them, because what people would do is they would pay their county taxes, town and county taxes, and they wouldn't pay their village taxes. And the village had no way to foreclose. So similar to what you're saying, you're exactly right. We don't want people to get behind and not be able to threaten them with the foreclosure proceeding.
There was one really interesting point that came up in that meeting. Apparently in Long Island, 80% of the tax assessments on average are contested, which is just mind-boggling.
Wow. Whoa, that's fun. Deborah, was there much debate or comment on the dark store resolution?
Not really, because I think a lot of people hadn't encountered it before, because we're the progressive county.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. So your resolution, Mike?
Resolution E. This is ID 8868. Resolution to update the administrative policy manual, policy 0830, open meetings. I'm going to move it, but then I'm going to have an amendment. So I do move this.
Second by Amanda. Go ahead, Mike.
After we had done this in Government Operations Committee, I was contacted by our Deputy County Administrator, Lisa Holmes, and she said there had been discussion at another departmental meeting. In the open meetings law, we had included, for example, the Public Health Board and the Mental Health Services Board. They brought up that also the Workforce Development Board should be added every place that those other two are listed. So I would hopefully it would be friendly. It's friendly to me to add that whenever it's mentioned within the resolution.
I see. Amanda nodding.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Anna.
I have a question on packet page 12, section 2 policy. There's A, which says all meetings of the legislature, committee standing, ad hoc, blah, blah, will, with the exception of executive sessions in accordance with public officers' law. But then in the second one, it says simply that they'll be open to the public. So I'm wondering, does that mean, therefore, that they're not subject to the law? If that's not specified, and specifically, later on in the resolution, it says that from those meetings, minutes will be available upon request, but if they are not subject to the law, they wouldn't be required to take minutes. So they wouldn't have any minutes to offer if they were requested. So it feels like those two are contradictory.
The issue
at best.
The issue of minutes was discussed, particularly with respect to the advisory boards and subgroups that we have, were discussed extensively. Some folks thought there ought to be minutes of everything. Some folks thought that it was kind of beyond what we could expect when you got EMC, for example, having a subgroup with two or three members, and are they going to get together and have open meetings and notices and minutes of the little subgroup. And so we decided not to go that deep into it, but to have the minutes for the major groups that have been mentioned here. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
Not really, not fully anyway. I mean,
let me go to Deborah. I think she's
Can I finish my question? My question, and I'll repeat it, is that if that is the direction you decide to go, then those two statements are contrary, one saying minutes will be available upon request, but if they are not held to the law, then they wouldn't be taking minutes necessarily.
Well,
the only last thing that I will offer on that is just a cautionary note. When I first started on the legislature, I was on the Human Rights Commission, where no notes were taken, and it caused substantial issues for us for years.
All right, let me give Deborah a crack at it.
Well, there's a distinction between the legislature committees standing or ad hoc or special of the legislature and meetings of the Board of Health, the Community Health Services Board, and now the Workforce Development Board, and meetings of advisory boards, committees, commissions, et cetera. They're treated differently. The first are subject to the open meetings law, which means they're noticed and there are minutes. The second are only open to the public. They're not required to meet the other requirements of the open meeting laws because we were told by various staff that some departments have so many advisory boards and ad hoc committees and stuff that they just can't keep up with the workload of doing the notices and the minutes and providing staff to take minutes. And you'll notice there's a distinction. The minutes provision only applies to those meetings that are subject to the open meetings law, not to the other ones.
packet page 14, last line, minutes, section 2. Those are advisory boards, committee, commissions, and that says minutes shall be made available to the public upon request, and that feels
that
contrary
should,
to me.
Yeah, okay. That should be removed, I think. I think that
those,
was
that's what I'm referring to.
I don't know about that. I think I don't. All right, Amanda? Well,
I had the exact same question, and I don't remember, but Lisa had an explanation, and I let it go. So it was, I don't know, Dan, if you remember what the explanation was, but I think it was referring to the advisory boards and stuff that do take minutes, but not necessarily the ones who don't. So if there are minutes, they would be available. But it is it definitely is a contradictory statement, but Lisa had some answer for it.
So maybe it could be added, minutes shall be made available to the public upon request if minutes are available.
If they're available.
All right, can I ask Jason, do you have a clarification?
No, I think that's exactly it, is that because advisory boards aren't required to be compliant, they don't require to comply with the open meetings law, they're open to the public, which is different, they're also not required to take minutes, but if they do and request it, they can be provided. I think that's what it was.
Mike?
Yeah. And we did talk about that and basically said that if minutes weren't taken and there was a request, the answer would be that there weren't minutes. But I don't have a problem if you wanted to add a couple of words like that.
Yeah, I think the my memory is most of the bylaws that we pass for these various advisory boards, and we're not talking about the subcommittee, but the main advisory boards and HRC Human Rights Commission should have been following this process. The bylaws usually talk about the minutes and passing the minutes and that, you know, that sort of thing. So, Anna?
I'd like to amend packet page 14, the last line where it says minutes shall be made available for the public upon request, that it add if minutes are available.
I think Mike just said
that's friendly.
I'm just offering the exact wording for yep. Kathy.
That's
and
fine.
They haven't been noted to be friendly to both, so I'm making it formal.
Amanda, that's good? Okay. So that is if minutes are available. Is there any other place it should go? Anybody? Glenn?
I have a question, Michael. Executive sessions, you reference Article 7, Section 105 of the Public Offices Law in three places in this the document. My question is, why didn't you list the 8 or 10 reasons why you can go into executive session here?
Why do we have to have reasons?
Yeah, why didn't you?
That's state law.
I know that, Michael.
I don't understand.
Why didn't you list in this document
what those
are, reasons why we can go into executive office?
Oh, you're asking what they are?
No, I'm asking why you didn't add it on to that article.
I was asking that they be added.
You want those particular things added?
That's my question. Why didn't you add that?
Well, I think it's because this is in reference to the open meetings law itself, and simply by having a policy that references the law, they're in the law.
Incorporates.
And then if the law changes, if we've only
right.
listed 8 and they add something else, we
don't have to change it every time.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. While I go to Dan, if somebody would really check to see if that clause about the minutes should be added anywhere else, that'd be great. Dan?
I did not see it.
We discussed this policy in GO 3 consecutive meetings, and we had 2 separate votes on it. The first vote made a change that I had requested, and the second vote 2 months later took it out. I'm going to share what my suggestion to add is with this whole legislature. It's going to take a minute or 2 or 3. There are 3 incidents that I am aware of that I was personally involved in with groups calling themselves subcommittees of the legislature, subcommittees of a committee of the legislature. 2 of those incidents happened since I've been in the legislature. 1 happened before I was on the legislature, when I was working for a program that was funded with public tax dollars that was overseen by the legislature. And in all 3 of those incidents, it was basically the same thing. There was a committee, and the committee said, we want to discuss or explore a certain topic, and you, you're the subcommittee, and you're going to discuss that topic. And that subcommittee went and met somewhere, in some room somewhere, and came back and said, here's what we decided. And that meeting was not open to the public. That meeting, there was no notice given of that meeting. There were no minutes taken of that meeting. And it was reported and then just became the policy or the decision. If you look at packet page 12, the legislative policy statement of this policy, I'm just going to read it. It is essential to the maintenance of a democratic society that public business be performed in an open and public manner, and that the citizens of this county be fully aware of and able to observe the performance of public officials and attend and listen to the deliberations and decisions that go into the making of public policy. And where that comes from, and the reason we want that, is because that is the open meetings law. That is New York State open meetings law. And if we pass this policy without including subcommittees and advisory boards and commissions, whatever title they're going to give themselves, if we pass it without including those, then we are basically saying, well, here's how you get around the open meetings law. Just call yourself a subcommittee, and then you don't have to invite anybody in. You don't have to make anybody aware of what's going on, the public or the legislator itself. These incidents happen without the legislators knowing that these committees were meeting. So I'm going to make an amendment, which is packet page 12, the very first line. Add in the word subcommittee, comma, advisory boards, comma, commissions, comma.
Wait, where?
Packet page 12, the very first line, the very top line.
Of the whole page?
Mm-hmm.
All meetings of the legislature?
Right now it says all meetings of the legislature, all committees, and then I would add right in there subcommittees, comma, advisory boards, comma, commissions, comma, and then it continues as is written. And then I would also eliminate the very next paragraph, paragraph B, because it would no longer be relevant. That's my amendment.
Is there a second for that? Shauna seconds. Rich, you had your hand up.
I did. At the GO committee, we went back and forth on this, and I just wanted to state the other side of that. I agree with you that in those three instances you cite, that was bad procedure, that we shouldn't have that, the public should know what the deliberations are. But I would suggest that the mistake was made at the committee level and not at the subcommittee level, that it's an obligation if you're running a committee to basically outline what is the substance of what was decided in a subcommittee or an advisory board that's coming before the full committee. And make sure that the public is aware of it there in the context that those committee meetings are noticed and minutes are kept and it is a formal proceeding. I worry that we are so fortunate in the advisory board participants that we have in our county. We get tremendous expertise. But if we make it very bureaucratic and difficult for people to serve, we may not get that kind of participation. And so that's the trade-off here, and that's what we were talking about at GO.
Anna, and then Mike.
I guess I'm really struggling with the same thing Dan is on this one. And I'd like to hear a little bit more. I mean, I hear what you're saying, that the decision was made because you're concerned about excessive bureaucracy deterring good people from participating, and I'm curious what that bureaucracy is exactly. It seems that the issue not is that it would be bureaucracy for volunteers that would simply have to, I don't really know what the burden would be on them because they wouldn't necessarily be taking notes and doing all the work. They would, I guess, appoint a secretary who would take minutes on actions taken, but that could be extremely short, as we all know. It seems more that committees And advisory boards are staffed by our departments, so the burden is more on our staff. And I guess I'm trying to understand if I'm wrong on that. I thought that this was the concern was the impact on staff.
That is the concern. Okay. That a lot of these advisory boards, I believe, are not staffed, and staff are not taking minutes. And if we made this amendment, staff would have to attend all those meetings, have to do public notices, have to do the scheduling in order for us to meet our burden of what we set up in this policy. It would be a significant increase in staff involvement and time. And that's particularly what the planning board or planning department had indicated.
So was the advisory board, the way that it was prior to this amendment, Martha, you made a comment in response to my comment about the Human Services Commission. Was it prior to this a requirement for all advisory boards to follow open meetings law, and that's the amendment that's being requested, that that be shifted? Because if that's not the case, then they didn't violate anything. It just, independent of violating or not violating, I am torn because of the pickle it put us in.
Okay, so I'll ask Mike to confirm, and he's next anyway, but I'm looking at the crossed out paragraph A, we're still at packet page 12, which looks like everything that looks like a committee, you know, well, I guess everything is open to the public. That's not relevant to the minutes. I wasn't part of any of that discussion. I'm going to go to, I got Mike Lane, Deborah, Amanda Rich, Dan, and Mike Sigler.
Wait, can you answer the question? Can someone answer?
I'm going to Mike. He's the chair of the committee. He was up next anyway. So.
This just seems an awful lot like committee work. Can we just send it back to the committee?
We don't want it back.
What?
We don't want it back. Can I speak?
Yeah, you're next.
Dan's comments were correct in that when he first brought this up at the GO committee meeting, we thought it made kind of a lot of sense what he talked about. Then the amendment that he had offered was reviewed at a department head meeting, and that's when we learned and got the feedback about the administrative problems that we would have through some of the departments and why GO then relooked at it and decided not to go with his wording. Not only is it a burden for a small subcommittee to be required to do all the noticing and the minutes and all of that, but the other problem that came forward was the quorum problem. Because a lot of times you got maybe a three-person subcommittee of EMC or something, and so-and-so calls in, I'm sick, now we don't have a quorum, and we don't have a meeting, so now you got to re-notice the meeting. And try to find a location and everything else for it. So the quorum issue is a big one on these advisory commission subcommittees that we have. As we know, a lot of the advisory boards have trouble, even in the main meetings, getting their quorums together. So I think that was the reason we made the change and why I wouldn't support Dan's change back at this point.
I'm going to inject a question to see if I can clear up something a little bit. Is it true that any of these committees can't take action on their own? Anything that they might decide can only be a recommendation to the board that they are a subcommittee of,
yes,
that then recommends to the legislature? So there are at least two more bites at the apple in terms of public notice and comment and awareness and all. Okay, just want to know. All right, Deborah, Amanda, Rich, and Dan.
Well, thank you, Martha. That pretty much introduces my point, which is that whatever this recommendation is that might come from the subcommittee, it has to be or should be approved by the advisory board and then sent to the program committee and then put before the legislature. And at the point where we as committees and legislators are making decisions, the public has every opportunity to hear that debate. And given the objections that came from staff about the burdens of staffing all of these meetings and the impossibility of really imposing on volunteers the obligation to take good minutes, this policy is the compromise that we reached.
Somebody just get Lisa out of bed.
Lisa.
Norm.
Jason, did you text her?
Well, I have to be honest, it was not me. Lisa is so engaged in policy commitment. She was like, I can't. Do you want me to come over and clarify? I said, well, if you're not doing anything.
Wow. Those don't look like your pajamas. So, hi.
Lisa.
I was working next door and I was watching on.
Oh, that's sad on so many levels, but.
It's true.
We're delighted.
More shovel in the ground.
Always, a question of her dedication.
Always delighted to see you, Lisa. So, how about we, so you've been watching, you've heard almost everything you said except for the like walking across the parking
right.
lot. So, before we go to everybody on the list, how about you talk to us about this policy? Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, sure. I'm just going to put my glasses on. So, it's true, we have discussed this policy at the last three GO meetings, taking it back and forth because of the department head feedback and the, you know, some of the burdens that it would place on departments that have multiple committees and subcommittees like the planning department, not all of which are staffed. So I heard that part of the conversation. I do think that the adding the language about the minutes being made available when available to the public when upon request would be a good addition. So I'm kind of on my walk over, I'm not sure where we're at in the discussion about what the clarification remaining is needed.
Right. I think we're basically debating the merits of should we be, in the interest of transparency, which we all value, where do we draw the line? I think it's kind of the issue of we have certain committees and boards that have public notice, public minutes, and all the rest. That's one level, and then other meetings that happen don't necessarily have all of that, but if somebody's taking minutes, those minutes will be available to the public. And any of those meetings are open to the public for somebody else to attend as well. Do I have kind of that right? Okay.
Yeah, and I think that we were, when we were considering making all advisories and subcommittees subject to open meetings law, which they're not under the interpretation of the law, but if we made the extra step in Tompkins County to do that, it would be very difficult for many of our advisory committees and subcommittees to comply with that. So we would have a policy that would be very difficult for many departments to comply with. So this was, after a back and forth with that, this was somewhat of a middle ground where we are certainly in compliance with open meetings law for the legislature in any committee that has decision-making authority. And for those that are strictly advisory in capacity, we are still holding them to accountability that we want the public notice to be posted, and that when minutes are available, we want them to be made available to the public.
Okay, and this has been discussed by GO three times in three committee meetings?
Yes.
Okay, I've got Amanda, Rich, Dan, Anna, and Annie. If I've missed anybody, let me know. Amanda?
Just to Mike Ziegler's point, like they said, we've talked about it three times, and I think Dan is looking for everyone else's input here. So, and let's see, what did I want to say? I I guess in terms of minutes, I don't, like, staff does not currently go to all the subcommittees and the, you know, all the advisory boards and everything like that. So I'm not sure that including this would say that they would have to go to all those. I think it would put the burden on the volunteers, but that's part of the job. There's, you know, a lot of them have a secretary and a chair, and, you know, that, I think that's totally legitimate to ask volunteers to do that. I guess, and I do appreciate Dan's point that it really should be, they should be subject to this. I guess I come back to the fact that it does have, the subcommittees have to go to the full committee, and then if there's any action, they advise the legislature. So I do think decisions are made in small committees that we don't know about and the public doesn't necessarily know about. I'm not sure that there's a way to remediate that without, unless there's other great ideas. But I do think the whole public notice thing and the quorum would be very difficult for small committees.
Rich.
I would just say the way to remediate it is on the committee level, that there is a full explanation of the source of the information and some summary of what the issue is. That's good committee work, and that's frankly what we're charged with doing.
You mean at the legislature committee level?
Right.
When a subcommittee brings a position?
When the issue arrives at a decision-making body, being one of the functional committees of the legislature, it should be briefed on where this came from, the advisory board, and some summary of here was the issue and here were, you know, a summary of the discussion in some manner so that the public can understand where it came from.
Presumably that's what the advice is. In other words, right, they're advising the legislature, say the program committee, that you have to explain your advice. So, Dan, Anna, and then Annie.
Thank you. Okay, yeah, I just want to, Amanda sort of said this, but yeah, staff, there's nothing here that says staff is required to attend these meetings. And, you know, we're already entrusting these volunteers to grapple with these tough issues. And then on the other hand, that we're saying, like, how can we possibly get them to take notes? I don't know, that seems wrong to me. If this is a meaningful process, then it's not that much to ask someone to write down the date, who was there, and what votes, if any, were taken. That's what minutes are. That's all that needs to be done. In Mike's example about the quorum, I have the same kind of question. Like, if we have a subcommittee of three and only two show up, and therefore they can't take official action, I mean, do we want two people making a decision? Like, how is that a meaningful process anyway, if there's just two people in a room, or even three people in a room deciding something that nobody else is there for? I don't see the quorum. If they can't fill a quorum, we've done this with some of our committees that have bylaws. We've changed the bylaws to make it so that they can work. Okay, if they can't pull a quorum together, something's not right about the committee or about the subject they're working on. I'll leave that one there. Another point that's been made is we have this accountability process where, so if something's discussed at a subcommittee, well, even if no one's there for it, it's going to make it to the committee, which is going to make it to the legislature. And that's true, but first of all, the reality is, and I think most of you know this that have participated in these groups, that when a group comes forward and says something, this is what we're going to do, it just kind of gets calcified. It becomes the topic. It becomes the decision. And yes, things do make it to here, to the legislature, and the public has an ability to weigh in at that point. But, and where is the public tonight? And how many times do they get to weigh in, for instance, on our consent agenda? Because that's where a lot of this stuff ends up in. The truth is technically there's opportunity for the public to weigh in, but it's not particularly meaningful, especially at the time that it's being crafted. And I'll ask you this too, if why do we have the open meetings law apply to the committees at all? Like, why, if they're just giving it to us anyway, and we're the ones taking the action, And this is the time when the public can weigh in. Why does it matter that the committees are subject to the open meetings law? It matters, I'll answer my own question, because the public should be present and have the ability to be present and question and participate at all levels. So just because, yes, the public still gets to see it, isn't an argument about why they shouldn't see it from its beginning.
Anna.
Well, I see both sides, and I really appreciate your perspective, Dan. It seems like we're looking at what is the ideal that we'd like to see in government versus adjusting to what's the reality. I'm curious, you've mentioned, Lisa, the departments. Is there a unanimous perspective from the departments? And I'm curious, have all departments weighed in that this is the policy that they would like to see? I'm just curious about staff input.
I think the second time bringing this back to department heads, this revision, they felt more comfortable with. And I would say that, you know, the majority of departments have one or two advisory committees that they work with, but there are, you know, a few departments that have multiple, and I know the planning department have, I think it was 36 advisory committees and subcommittees. So that department was the one that was going to be the most affected by this and had the most to say about it, because the volunteers that would be involved with those committees and subcommittees don't necessarily have, you know, posting rights to the county webpage. And so there will be staff involvement even if they're not attending those meetings, you know, rounding up the minutes, being able to post them and make them available, et cetera. So they saw that as, you know, a fair amount of work that they would have to do. So they felt that this iteration addressed those concerns.
Annie.
Two things. One, as far as if minutes are taken at subcommittees or advisory committees or boards, do we want to have those centralized, posted in a centralized area versus somebody asks for them and then, okay, then who knows, who has that knowledge of which boards and committees are taking minutes and where they are? So that's one thing. And then another thing, I would feel very strongly if we're going to make, to me, would be a major edit would that Dan is suggesting, as far as, to me, that's a major edit, and that I would want that taken back to maybe the subcommittees or the staff, because that's a lot different than what you said department heads agreed upon or thought was okay.
That was the initial one.
To clarify, that was the first iteration of the policy did make all advisory committees and subcommittees subject to open meetings law. So that was the first iteration that went back, and where department heads shared those concerns. So that was brought back with that feedback, and then this was adjusted as a result of that.
So the open meetings would, to clarify in my own head, so the open meetings is about posting and making those meetings available to the public and the minutes, or are the taking the minutes a separate thing? Are minutes required under open meetings law?
Jonathan?
Yeah. So to kind of go back a little bit.
Can you pull the mic closer?
Sure. So under the open meetings law, committees that are subject to the open meetings law are required to post notice,
to be open to the public, and to take minutes. So all of those three apply to those groups which are subject to the open meetings law. The groups that are subject to the open meetings law are those which make decisions. Groups that are purely advisory are not subject to the open meetings law. So when you say, for example, do minutes apply for those that are subject to the open meetings law, they definitely have to keep minutes. For those that are not, it's up to the legislature what our policy would be.
So, for example,
ones that make decisions, that's the clarification.
Right. So there are certain advisory committees, yeah, some of which are mentioned in specifically in the policy, such as the Board of Health, which by law make decisions. So they must be open to the public. There are others that are purely advisory, don't make decisions. Those are not by law subject to the open meetings law.
Unless you say that they are.
That they are, or you know, any part of the open meetings law, you could say that they are.
Thank you.
So, like, make decisions impose fines on, you know, for noncompliance with a septic permit or mental health. I mean, this is why you've got these three. They're in law, and they have authorities that are independent of us. They're not advising us about whether we should impose fines on a restaurant for noncompliance. They have that authority directly. So that's why they're in this policy. In fact, what you're saying, if I hear you right, Jonathan, is that what we've got here is actually going beyond what the open meetings law requires.
By requiring that they be public. Say that because those that are not subject to the open meetings law really don't have any requirements other than what you said.
That's right. Okay. I'm pretty sure no more minds are getting changed.
Actually, I have a comment, Martha.
So I got Annie and Amanda, but let's try to end this if we can.
You mean Anna?
Anna.
And then the one comment that I wanted to make, I'm going to throw this out there, y'all, just for us to make it muddy and think about. I'm going to take a really controversial topic that is going to be coming back. County public forest lands. I'm going to paint a scenario. I'm going to bring it up because, you know what, we might as well bring it up now. I'm going to paint a scenario, and then I don't know what my answer is, but I'm curious. So we've got a scenario where we have a subcommittee that's an advisory board. Then that advisory board has a subcommittee. That subcommittee to the advisory board is going to be giving input. Neither one of them would need to take minutes. We have some people that have the philosophy that if we are asking experts of that caliber to give us that level of input, that we shouldn't then constantly be micromanaging and sending it back to them and telling them, please dictate to us why you came to the conclusion that you came to, because we might not agree with you. I'm painting a scenario here. That it ends up going back and back and back and back. Is our philosophy that when we ask incredible experts to give us input, that we just trust it? Or I'm throwing it out here, that we trust it. So here's a scenario. We have this subcommittee to the EMC.
Right.
Here's an actual real live case.
Right. So that subcommittee is going to write a report that's going to go to the EMC.
Right.
And there will be debate about it at the EMC. And then the EMC will bring it to PEAK. There will be debate about it at PEAK. So presumably the report will give reasons why they've recommended X, Y, or Z. But if they don't, then the EMC or
maybe
PEAK.
Maybe they didn't unanimously agree to it. And we want to know who did, who didn't, and we want to understand.
But
I'm just saying,
those are
painting a picture.
I think the issue is the work product is not the minutes. The work product is the report, and that's the advice to us. And then we chew it around the way we're going to do it.
As long as our policy is that, Martha.
I mean, that
we always ask those subgroups to give us a report, which to me, then it's fine. Then it's a replacement for minutes. What if we haven't asked them to give us a report?
And if they give us advice that we don't agree with or we don't feel is substantiated, we can ask them to go back and do a report. It's the work product is the report, not the minutes. Amanda and then Deborah.
Okay. I think I might have a solution. Because there's these separate parts of the actual law, right? And so on page 12, under B. So what we did in GO was we separated out the legislature from the advisory boards. So what we've done in B is say that all the advisory boards and commissions are open to the public. That's one part of the public meetings law. So what if we say the advisory boards, they're open to the public and they must take minutes? But that doesn't say that the staff has to go and take those minutes. It also doesn't make anybody have to put a public notice, which could be a burden, but they would have to take minutes.
Okay.
I'm looking at Dan because I'm wondering if that's
okay.
Amenable.
Why wouldn't you just say they're subject to the open meetings law?
Because then you're excluding out the public notice part and the quorum part.
Okay. Before I ask you if that's an amendment and look for a second, let me clarify. So if meetings are taken, presumably they then have to be approved, or else they just draft somebody's note, so then there's a vote, and then are they posted? And I mean, I think it spirals quickly, and I have to say, the committee talked about this 3 times and had a 4-1 vote. The staff talked about it at length. I feel like if this is going to go on any longer, it should go back to committee. So I'm going to ask if there's anybody. I think, Glenn, you had your hand up, and I haven't heard from you.
I just want to call the question, Martha.
All right. Is there a second to calling the question? Second. What?
What is the question?
Calling the question. Vote.
She didn't make an amendment. She made a comment, and there hasn't been a second.
I didn't make an amendment.
But Dan has an amendment on the floor.
Dan has an amendment.
Got it. Thank you. Okay. So the question is on Dan's amendment, right?
Right.
Moved by Glenn, seconded by Anna. All in favor of calling.
All in favor of calling. Okay.
Of calling the question on Dan's amendment. Please raise your hand. Any opposed?
Oh, I'm sorry.
To calling the question. That's unanimous to call the question. So, Dan, would you remind us what your amendment is, or Kathy, you have it, or?
I don't mind what Kathy. Okay. So, packet page 12, number, Roman number 1, policy A would say all meetings of the legislature, all committees, comma, subcommittees, comma, advisory boards, comma, commissions, comma, and then it would continue as is, standing, ad hoc, etc. And it would eliminate B under that same section.
There would have to be additional conforming amendments to the rest of the, but we can.
Let's assume if we get the intent voted here, we'll clean up the details, right? Okay. Ready to vote? All in favor of that amendment, please raise your hand. Opposed? How many people we have? 12? All right, that fails 2-10. So we're back to the main motion of the policy, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What? Lisa?
No.
All right, we're ready to vote on the resolution with the policy, the only change to adding the Workforce Development Board on PAC on the top of page 12.
Anna's addition 14. On page 14.
Page 14, that's why I thought we were there. Page 14, the very end said if minutes are available. Okay? Are you voting or are you asking a question? You want to talk? Okay.
I'd like to make an amendment to on page 12, the first line, to all meetings of the legislature, and add in there commissions.
Second. Okay. Discussion.
What commissions are there?
What is a commission?
Human Rights Commission.
Human Rights Commission.
I would like Human Rights Commission to be in open meetings law.
Yes, to be notified that they're having meetings.
Historical Commission. That happens to be the name. I think it's a generic name. I don't think it's a meaningful definition of it. There's not a. Jason, Jonathan.
You can have commission. Commission is a name. It could.
span across, it could span across several different types of advisory boards that don't have authority to do anything. Like the Historical Commission, I don't think they have any authority to do anything.
They have a budget.
I'm talking about history. So I think it touches on a variety of things that could come up just by labeling it as commission.
Their spending comes to us for approval.
What's then, do we have any commissions?
You have a, I mean, you have the Human Rights Commission.
That's why I brought it up.
You have the Historical Commission. I mean, I'd have to look through the list of commissions that you've had in the past. You have the Bicentennial. Was that a commission or a committee?
Commission.
It was a commission.
Civil War Commission.
Civil War Commission. I'm sensing a theme here.
So that was moved by Anna. That was moved by you. Was that? Did I get a second?
Annie seconded by me.
By me.
Moved by Annie. Seconded by Anna. Shauna.
I would really hope that we don't do this just for the Human Rights Commission. And I understand that we've had some hard times with that office, with the commission, but making them really the exception to this rule, I don't think is a good idea.
That kind of point could be in the bylaws of the group, which bylaws are going to be looked at. I think that would be probably a good addition to that. I think, look, I hope we don't spend another half hour on this, and I think if the issue is authority versus advice, and commissions don't have the authority as the Workforce Development Board and the Mental Health Services Board, et cetera, have. So, all right. Did I see Mike? Did you have your hand up? Was there a hand over on this side? All right.
I'm ready to vote on the amendment.
Are we ready to vote on the amendment? All in favor of adding the word commissions to that top line on packet page 12? Please raise your hand. Adding commissions to that line. Two, three. Any opposed? That's fails 9-3. All right, we're ready to vote on the main motion and the policy. All in favor of the resolution with the amendment?
I would like to just have one thing in the record.
Yes.
We have more than one commission. That was not particularly for one commission.
Okay. All in favor of resolution E, please raise your hand. Keep your hands up, please, because it's not unanimous. 1, 2, 5, 6. Opposed. 1, 2, 3, 4. That passes 8-4. Lisa, thank you very much for coming over. Now you're really going to go back to work, and we're sorry, but thank you very much. All right. Anything else, Mike, Lane?
I'm sorry?
Anything else for your report?
No.
Okay. Can I get a motion on the... Oh, Pete.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So I'm sorry for Jim up there. We usually get a break at 7:30. I thought we were going to be gone by now. I got the Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you. Our meeting this Monday will be the Plastic Fantastic Meeting. We are finally getting a report from Barb Ekstrom, who's been waiting to get guidance from the state of New York on implementation of the plastic bag ban. We will be considering our recommendation on a paper bag fee. We will be discussing the possibility of an extended polystyrene foam ban, which has been requested as the subject of numerous letters that we've received from the public. But anyway, I won't go into that in too much depth. We're also going to be considering the possibility of banning plastic water bottles at the airport and talking about straws.
You mean for sale at the airport, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's all the plastic there is to be dealt with.
Thank you, Deborah. Mike.
If you
Are you going to ban soda cans and stuff at the airport?
Well, you know, that's one of the things we're going to have to discuss. You know, do we want, if you start banning things that come in plastic bottles, do you want to extend that across the board? And I would like to get some input from Mike Hall, who will probably be in attendance.
It would just seem to me if you can't get a drink of water out of a bottle, you'll get a drink of something else out of a bottle.
Well, and that's a very good point, Mike.
Come on and join the discussion.
But soda comes in aluminum cans, too. But you know, all of these decisions really require some input from Barb, because it's going to, any decision like that has an impact on our recycling stream.
And this is the first discussion at PEEQ, and I'm sure it won't be the last.
No, you know, we're not going to make a lot of decisions about this stuff. Maybe a recommendation on paper bags.
Okay. Any other questions for Deborah? Can I get a motion on the minutes of September 3rd, moved by Anna, seconded by Annie? Any comments, discussion? All in favor of the minutes, please raise your hand. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Can I get a motion to adjourn? Moved by Anna, seconded by Deborah. All in favor? Thank you. We're adjourned.